Abigail Gimpo, how are you? Thanks for being on the podcast.
Thank you so much. It's such a pleasure being here with you, Shane.
So we have a really interesting conversation ahead of us today. You know, you're a mom, a special educator, author, and researcher into ADHD. And you've recently, or not so recently, written a couple of books about all of the research that you've done into ADHD and its causes and symptoms and how to treat it, especially with regards to children, which is a bit of an alternative to the mainstream view, which is really basically just let's medicate them. You take a much more practical and pragmatic approach to understanding what are the causes of the various symptoms and how can we start to address those from a more, I would say, psychosocial and behavioral perspective. And so, yeah, so we're going to get into it. Oh, your program and your books are called Hyperhealing, before I forget. And I'll include links and everything in the description below. So people should definitely check that out. But so how about we just start off with a little bit about you? What got you so invested and interested in ADHD?
It's interesting how sometimes your profession invites you and not the other way around. I did start off as a special education teacher before I met my children, and I loved being in the classroom, and I specifically loved the kids with the what I called special energy, the kids that were interested in everything and bouncing off the walls or spacing out and looking out the windows, all the versions of it. I really loved it. And as a special education teacher, you really get to specialize in anything you want. You can go for reading. You can work with spectrum. You could, there's so many areas that you can really deep dive into. And my ADHD students drew me right in, and I'm like, those are my guys. Those are the ones that I feel like I'm missing something. I got to figure something out. And then I met my husband that year that I was teaching mainly boys with ADHD symptoms. And I always joke with him that he was so similar to my students and his temperament. And that's probably why I fell in love with him, because it was familiar. It was fun. It was refreshing. And ADHD symptoms are most definitely also genetic. And most of my six children are diagnosed with ADHD as well. And the only reason not all of them are diagnosed with ADHD is because I stopped going to get a diagnosis. I'm like, I get it. I understand. Thank you very much. But that really invited me in. And once it was my own children, it really became personal. And that's when the research began, the why and what's going on for these kids and why are we choosing medication as the first line of treatment. Those questions started bubbling to the surface when I really started doing the research.
Mm-hmm. So you're a naturally inquisitive and curious person. And so, you know, when the doctors were like, oh, your kid has ADHD, you wanted to know everything, right?
Oh yeah. I actually dedicated my second book, which did come out recently, just a couple of months ago, Hyperhealing, Show Me the Science, to curiosity. Because I think that we always have to be open to asking questions and finding out why and not taking things at face value. And as a famous quote from Jordan Peterson, assume that the person you're speaking to knows something you don't know. And that's always the way I approach things. And when a doctor says to me, this is what we're going to do, I want to understand why we're doing that. Give me the background, trace me through it. Why is this good for my child? Is this for everyone? Or is this specifically the right fit for my kid? Mm-hmm. And that's what got me to where I am.
Right. And so how did that sort of first contact go for you with your first child when they got the diagnosis of ADHD?
I actually write about it in the book. Which book? I don't remember. I think it's the second book where that encounter, I describe it. It was quite absurd, because I take my daughter, who is a very bright, energetic person. She's 23 and wonderful. And I take her to the doctor's office. We're having the best time. And then we go into the doctor's office and she's kind of busy with something else, which she's just ignoring us. And we carry on having a fun conversation with each other. And then she presses the print button and my daughter hears everything. she's very musical also. So any noise in the room is going to catch her ear. And she hears that button and she hears a whirl of the printer. And she leaps out of her seat, runs to the printer, yanks the page out and hands it to the doctor. And like, and is expecting a big compliment for what she'd just done because it was so helpful. And the doctor looks at me for the first time and says, slam dunk, ADHD. And I'm like, what? What are you saying? And I know ADHD. ADHD and I, we've been hanging out for a while, but like, that's the process? That's it? Don't you want to ask us some questions? And she's like, no, you filled out these forms. I see all the scales, the rating scales. You're up at 5 on most of them. And the teacher put you way up at, you know, 22 on everything. So she's got ADHD and here's your prescription.
Mm-hmm.
That did not work out well for me.
No, I wouldn't think so. And it's interesting, you know, so like when we look at how ADHD is diagnosed these days, so firstly, it has to be by a doctor or a psychiatrist, which is also a doctor. And they just use a variety of measures where you basically have to fit into certain criteria, right? It's based on the Diagnostic and Statistics Manual, which is like psychiatry's textbook for diagnosing mental disorders, so to speak. And
some may even call it their Bible.
The Bible is, yeah, that's the word that they use. And you basically take a look and say, okay, well, if you display these certain symptoms or characteristics, a certain number of them over a certain period of time, that's when you meet the criteria for diagnosis. And it, you know, there's, I don't know, maybe 10 options and you have to meet, what is it, like 5 of them or something like that. And once you do that, then you get the diagnosis. And then according to, you know, the sort of standard medical models, it's like, okay, well, if you have this diagnosis, these are your medication options. And then the doctor makes a decision about which one at which dose would be best for the particular patient based on all of their demographics and history and things like that. And that's about it, right? And then they kind of send you away and say, okay, let's see what happens in a couple of weeks. Come back and check in, which is how you treat many diseases very effectively. But it doesn't seem to work so well with psychiatric illnesses a lot of the time. So what was your experience thereafter of like, once they had just said, you know, here's your meds for your, how old was your child? Did you say 6?
She was in second grade. So she must have 7 or she might've just turned 8.
Right. Which is so young.
It's quite young. I never recommend people go for any kind of evaluation till at least the end of first grade, but try to delay it.
Yeah. But to be starting medication at that age it's a lot, right? I mean,
well, people starting in kindergarten nowadays, we even have a good many hundreds of thousands of toddlers taking ADHD medication now in America.
Sure. And why do you think that is?
That's a great question. You said so many things just now that I want to.
Let's go one at a time.
Because you started there with the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, the DSM, and we're up to the DSM-5 because it's been revised a bunch of times. So that was one question that I had, like, what is this book? And is this scientifically reliable? Is it significant? Is it something that you can diagnose based on that? And once someone is diagnosed, what does that mean? Does that mean that they're disordered? Do we see anything physiological going on in that person? If someone has a diagnosis, does that mean there's something wrong with them? And if there's something wrong with them, where is it wrong with them? What's wrong with them? And then we go to the medication part. If we take a medication, what's it repairing? That's what we like to know. When we take an antibiotic, we know that we're killing a harmful bacteria. So we know that that's healing. If you take a medication for high blood pressure, then you know that it's bringing down the blood pressure. There's some kind of understanding of what that medication is doing in my body.
Mm-hmm.
And you said also that this model does not work in psychiatry, that we're, and the reason why this model does not work in psychiatry is because in all other areas of medication, we're no longer diagnosing people based on observable symptoms. When you go to the doctor and you say, my throat's hurting, The doctor doesn't say, is it your left side or your right side? How many hours a day does it hurt? Does it hurt when you cough or does it hurt when you sneeze? They don't do that. They observe it. They go inside. They take a swab. They find out if it's COVID, if it's stress, if it's strep, if it's so many reasons, you know, they want to take a blood test to see if maybe you have something that's causing you fatigue, which might make your throat hurt. There's so many reasons why your throat would be hurting. And therefore, a doctor would be foolish to make a diagnosis based on observable symptoms. Mm-hmm. Now we look at psychiatry, and the entire psychiatric model is, let's observe symptoms. We're going to make check marks in the areas where we see those symptoms. We're going to add that up, and then we're going to give you a diagnosis. So if we look at the DSM diagnosis, that was my first question. What's going on here? How did they get this list of symptoms? And I was shocked to find out that this list of symptoms is created by consensus. That means they vote on it. So the psychiatrists get together, and these are people that have been working with people for a very long time. I have high regard for them in terms of their professionalism. But what they're saying is, I see this symptom, that symptom. How often do you see this? They're comparing what happens in their different offices. And they say, oh yeah, that one's very significant. You know, cutting into adult conversations now, that happens a lot. So let's put that in here. And having, you know, inattention when an adult is talking to you. Okay, that's a good one too. And they put that in there. But is that significant? What do I need that for? And the truth is, when the DSM was written, it was actually created in order to make order in psychiatry, because you would go to one psychiatrist and you would get a diagnosis of bipolar. You'd get you go to another one on the same day and you get a diagnosis of depression. And therefore, it was just not a good experience to go to a psychiatrist, because everyone was doing their own thing. And it's a little bit embarrassing for psychiatrists to have that kind of way of treating patients. So therefore, they created a manual so that when I say ADHD and you say ADHD, we understand that it's this group of symptoms. It was never meant to be diagnostic. Once it turned diagnostic, we went off the rails. That's what happened, because if it's diagnostic, that means that it has to be caused by something. And the cause by something is the biggest story we hear, is that there's something wrong with the child's brain. And there's a problem with that too. And that's what I was asking. I'm looking at my child and I'm saying, she looks healthy. She looks like she is capable of doing what her friends can do. But there's something going on. She seems to be missing skills. She seems to have less inhibitions, things like that, that we see with kids with ADHD symptoms. Why? And then the doctor says, oh, I know why. Broken brain. And I said, based on what? Did you look at my child's brain? You can't say broken brain. You can't say broken throat based on seeing 10 other kids' throats today and saying, well, it's probably strep because I just diagnosed 10 other kids with strep. That doesn't work for me. I'm going for a second opinion and a new pediatrician. Thank you very much. But here, I have to rely on the doctor saying, no, I studied it in the books. I've seen the studies. And if you have these amounts of symptoms, you must have a brain disorder. And then they're going to tell me where I have the brain disorder. Oh, it's the frontal lobe and it's the neurotransmitter dopamine. And they're going to give me a whole fancy story. And it sounds really good, except that it might just not be accurate.
Mm-hmm.
And that's our problem.
Yeah. And I think that there's the important distinction to be made is between fact, theory, and opinion, right? And yes, they're not the same thing, even though they overlap sometimes. And that they change, like facts change, which is a very strange concept in science, but that's just true, right? Like,
sure,
it used to be a fact that the Earth was the center of the universe. It's now a fact that it's not.
Or that it was flat.
Or that it was, exactly. And so it's complicated to assert fact as absolute truth, even at the best of times in science. And medicine is a subfield of science for all intents and purposes. And so what's complicated is, like, well, because, you know, if we look at how they sort of came to these, the diagnostic of ADHD, like as you explore in your book, where you say, okay, well, there's a group of people, let's say children, who exhibit these symptoms, and they often they occur together, right? So something's going on, right? Because it deviates from so-called normal behavior, right? It's missing skills. It could be communication issues, emotional regulation issues, attention difficulties, you know, what else? Sleep issues, disorganization, whatever the list of symptoms are. They're like, okay, well, people fit these symptom categories. So something's going on, but we're not exactly sure what, right? So that's fair enough, right? Like sure. that's a good place to be. Exactly. And then they move on to theorizing about why that might be the case. And then ideally, you then study that to prove your hypothesis of your theory, to say that, okay, well, you know, if you hypothesize, well, it's a deficit in your prefrontal cortex and, you know, it's mediated by a dopamine issue. You're like, okay, fine, good theory, makes sense because of what we know about the prefrontal cortex and executive functions and about the way that dopamine affects our thoughts and behaviors and things like that. So fair enough. But then let's study it to say this is the case, right? You don't just assert that this must be true and then base everything else off that, which your book seems to suggest is what has happened.
Well, correct? There are many studies. There are many studies, and I run through a bunch of them in the book because I just find them fascinating. But the issue is that they're in what happens is that the headlines of the studies, and I put in a couple of headlines so we can see the difference between what we're reading in the press and what is actually going on in the study, because nobody reads the study, including the doctors, because they don't have any time. They have about 7 minutes per patient. So they are just reading the abstract and the headlines. And some of them are really great and they go down to the conclusion. But the stuff in the middle and all those graphs, only the nerds are looking at. And I guess that would put me in the nerd category. But the thing is that, let's say the 2017 study, which is our most recent enormous study, thousands of kids all over the world, really impressive the way they pulled the study together. And the conclusion is there are five different areas of the brain that are different in a child with ADHD. Therefore, ADHD is a neurological disorder. And therefore, there should be no stigma on children, and parents should understand that it's something wrong with the child's brain. I don't understand how that removes stigma, but those are the headlines that we got everywhere. And I remember those headlines coming out. And then you look at the study, and here we go. You put 100 kids with ADHD in a room. Don't do that. And then five of them, only 5% of the kids had something that seemed abnormal in their brains, but they weren't sure if it was abnormal, but it seemed different than the rest of the kids. That means that 95% of kids diagnosed with ADHD have a completely healthy normative brain. Now that should have been the headline. And there was another great headline that they should have had. The kids in the ADHD category had overall higher IQ. Now, wouldn't that have been a great thing to tell parents of kids with ADHD? I certainly would like to know. I know my kids are brilliant, but it'd be nice to get some feedback from the universe about that. But instead we have found it, and ADHD is absolutely neurological, and the conversation is over. This is 2017. They've been looking for this brain condition since the late 70s. That's a lot of years. And despite all that searching, they've come up with nothing. And when Martine Hoogman, who ran this whole study, she was challenged on that. And her response was, well, if 5% is not enough to declare it a brain disorder, then no psychiatric disorders are brain disorders. And I'm like, okay, well, thanks for that. Another great headline.
Yeah. It's very complicated, and the sort of like sensationalization of studies and which parts are important is very complicated, right? Because as you say, because most people don't have time or patience or perhaps even the ability to read and understand what studies and results mean, unless they're displayed in a very you know, careful, simple way, which they should be, obviously, for everyone. Like, I'm not saying you need to be smart, but it's like, if you don't know what certain statistics mean, then it's really hard to understand what's going on, right? And that's where the sort of conclusions need to be particularly relevant. But it's crazy that 5% they suggest means that it's the case, right? And it seems to me, I mean, I haven't read the study that you're talking about, but it's kind of like a chicken and egg problem, right? Although it's not exactly like that. It's like, well, this, even if we look at that subpopulation, it's like, well, they seem to have some sort of brain differences, right? Abnormalities might be a stretch, but let's say differences, right? And then they also have these symptoms. But now, where's the link between those two, firstly? Now, there might be a link. I'm not suggesting that there isn't one. Right.
But we must ask the question, right?
Yeah, but there might not be. And we must ask the question, and that must be investigated. And I mean, our brain science is so complicated at the best of times. Right. You know, like, we know a lot, but not even nearly enough to make like really firm conclusions about brain mechanisms, except in like a very few specific instances that have been studied so intensely. But even then, it's like, yeah, but that interacts with the rest of the body in ways that are so complicated that, you know, we're just starting to figure that out. And that's good. Like, we will figure it out, hopefully. I mean, maybe it takes a couple hundred years. Yeah.
We've come a long way in science.
Yeah. Yeah. Back from the days when we were drilling holes in people's heads to cure them and to release the demons and things like that. Like, that was not so cool. Or the lobotomies, which were 100 years ago.
Psychiatry is, and neurology is just riddled with a lot of horrible, horrible abuse to humanity, unfortunately. I'm hoping they're slowly starting to clean up their act there. Throwing drugs at kids is not great in terms of them regaining trust. It's interesting when you talk about the like, what comes first. Is it the brain? Is the brain the problem? Or something else causing it? And that has been looked at. There's one scientist called Castellanos who actually drew the conclusion that when he did his study and he found that there was a problem with the frontal lobe, he did it on a little under 60 children, which is a small study, but he did find that in majority of the kids, he was seeing abnormalities in the frontal lobe and different areas of the brain, but he was smart, was astute enough to conclude that this was not a reliable study because 98% of the kids in the study had already been treated with stimulant medication. And therefore, he couldn't answer the question whether the stimulant medication was causing the ADHD, was causing the brain abnormalities, or was it something that the children were born with? And therefore, the next study that should have happened was a comparison between same age, same weight children, that two groups having ADHD, one group that had been medicated and one group that hadn't. And then we would have gotten our answer. But that study has been blocked. And the reason it's been blocked is because the fact of the matter is that science has now concluded that medication for ADHD is so safe and so effective and so necessary for children that it would be unethical to run a study like this that holds back the medication from a full group of children, which is silly because there are full groups of children who are diagnosed with ADHD and are not medicating. And therefore, you could find the children. You don't have to create the groups. The groups already exist, and let's compare them. But we don't have that study, and I'd love to know why.
Yeah. And the other problem is that these kinds of studies, like, to do a true double blind placebo study is nearly impossible, right? Yeah. Because there are so many confounding variables that come into play that you just can't accommodate for. You can do your best to eliminate them, but, you know, like, just in the case of, let's say, this kind of stuff, it's like, okay, well, what kind of diet are these kids having? What kind of social life do they have? What's their household environment like? You know, do they have good relationships? what else is going on? It's like there's so many things where that could be influencing it. Did they have any injuries, or what kind of sport do they play? Are they getting knocked in the head a lot? Or like there's so many things that can come into play that it's so hard to study these kinds of things. Now, I'm not saying they shouldn't do it. Like, I think by and large, people try their best, right? But as you say, it's like, well, we must take these conclusions carefully in what they yes. mean and what the implications of them are, and try and replicate results in different populations under different conditions. And that's what science is really about, right? It's like trying, also there's the side of science which tries to disprove the hypothesis, which we've kind of lost our way a little bit, it seems to be, of being willing to challenge existing paradigms. You know, they're sort of so fixed in their assertion of it being the answer finally. And we see it in lots of areas these days where they're like, no, we have found the answer and that's right. the end of it. Stop studying. I don't know why that's the case. Maybe it's just the sort of state of our collective consciousness at the moment of just being like...
I think there's a good reason for it.
I think there's probably lots of reasons in different areas. Like, there's probably not one reason, but...
I'll throw one out there and see what you think of it.
Different.
A lot. And you tell me if you got something else to add. There's a lot of studies are conducted today by sponsored by pharma, which means that you need to get in the direction of a certain result. Now, obviously certain drugs fail, and that, mm-hmm. that does happen, but especially in psychiatry, it's really hard to get a drug fail because you have to compare it. It has to be slightly better than what's on the market already. There's a lot of these copycat drugs that really are very similar to what you have, and you've changed the molecule just slightly. And therefore, it's very easy to get approved for a new drug. And once you've been approved, you do not want anyone coming in and challenging that, because then you're blowing the market share on that drug. So most of these trials and a lot of the studies that we read are sponsored by pharma. The reason for that is governments don't have enough money for grants to create, you know, studies, but also because pharma actually wants these studies being run so that the lay people, you and I, can read them and be convinced of the best way to go, which is this pill, which is going to make all the difference. So yeah. you have a major financial push to get studies out there that are positive in the direction of, let's say, brain disorder, and therefore repairing the brain disorder with a pill. And you certainly don't want dissenting voices. And when a lot of the financial capability is on the side of pharma, then you're going to land up really shutting down a lot of the conversation.
That's fair.
That's my suggestion.
Yeah. That's fair. And I would expect then, though, that there would still be independent studies that get conducted, especially yeah. now with our global society where things get proven and disproven and challenged and things like that. But you're right, it wouldn't be the dominant big studies that require, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars of investment for one study. And, you know, like the risk is huge for people who invest in that kind of stuff, because what are you trying to do? And, you know, is there a financial return? Like, that's what all investment typically looks like these days, right? Sure. And it's like, if you're just sponsoring a study, it's like there's no financial return for you unless you can do something about it afterwards, like with the results. So it's very complicated. But the other complication is that, well, these drugs do help people, not everyone, but they do help people improve their symptoms significantly. So it's not like it's sure. snake oil, but it's maybe not wise to suggest that it's the only treatment available, or even the first line of defense. Now, that's a controversial kind of statement, and I don't really know what to think because I'm not an expert in these areas, right? But it is true that many people have their lives changed by these drugs, right? And sometimes in medicine, what they do, and it's very different when we're talking about children, but even with adults, it's like sometimes they say in medicine, what they say is, you know, thinking about side effects and long-term consequences and things like that, they say, well, basically, we sometimes we have to do stuff that has bad consequences so that worse stuff doesn't happen, right?
Right.
And an extreme example of that is like, if you take someone who's got cancer and you give them chemotherapy, right?
Sure.
Which absolutely wrecks them, which no person would ever take if there was no absolutely good reason to take it. But you do because you know that the other option is worse, right? And so even with psychiatric stuff, it's like sometimes you have to take these drugs because you need that in order to live properly. Otherwise, the other option is far worse, including death, right? And it's particularly obvious with like psychotic disorders and, you know, schizophrenia and people with bipolar disorder and things like that, where it's even various major depressive disorders and anxiety disorders. Like, yes, there are other ways, but sometimes that's just not good enough, right? So it's like, if I'm understanding you correctly, it's not like you're saying we should never use drugs, right? But what you're saying is like, well, we need to look into the drugs that we are using, how they work, why they're being prescribed, who should they be prescribed to, and what other options are there available for people?
Well, I would say, yes, I agree with you. I do not, I'm not a purist. I think that we need to look at the tools we have in our shed and be flexible enough to be open-minded and use whatever is best for the person we're trying to treat or for ourselves. Now, I medicated three of my children and, you know, of the six, so three of them got spared. And our experience and my children will still turn to me today, the three I medicated, and say, why did you do that to me? But that's not everybody's experience at all. So when I talk about medication, I'm not really asking the question of is this a thing you can use? Of course, it's a thing you can use. And of course, if a doctor recommends it, you should take that recommendation seriously. But the question I always ask is, what's causing your symptoms? That's number one. And you actually touched on that very well before. Is it your diet? Is it what's going on in your environment? Are you getting exercise? Are you going through any trauma or abuse? All those things, we need to really know that. Because if you're going through trauma or abuse, God forbid, and many children are, one in four girls are molested in their childhoods, and boys are not far behind that. A lot of kids are suffering with serious trauma. And if you go ahead and you treat that as a brain disorder and you give that child a pill and you shut the kid down, now what you've done is taken the child's only mechanism of protection, which is making a lot of noise and saying, something's wrong with me. Pay attention. I'm hurting. And then you're like, you're making too much noise with your hurt. So we never stop to say, what's going on with this child? Why is the child acting this way? It's a good kid. Why is she doing that? We don't do that. We give that child a pill. And guess what we did just now? We kicked the trauma down the road and now we turned into post-trauma. So congratulations, we haven't done anything to help that child. So when we go quickly to medication, let's say it's a gut dysbiosis. Now what have we done? Seriously, the child is sensitive to certain foods. Something's going on physiologically for the child. It's not a lack of Ritalin in the child's system that is making the child behave that way. Something's happening. So never run to drugs until you know what's going on. Now, let's say you figured out what's happening for the child and you say the kid needs a break. Let me give that kid 6 months to just gather himself together, feel some successes. And I'm very against giving a child medication because the classroom's not doing well. The teacher has to figure out how to discipline. And I'm saying that as a classroom teacher. I never blamed one student for the problems of discipline in my classroom. That was my fault. So if you can't keep your classroom together, you got to go back and study how to do that. And there's many methods, but you never medicate a child because they're bothering the adults. That's not a good option. But the other thing is when we do consider medication, so you say the kid needs a break. I see that there's something going on. It's trauma. We're going to do therapy. And we're also going to give medication so that the kid could just be okay for a little bit. Great. Good decision. But now what we have to do is really look at the medication, just like you said about the chemotherapy. There are some chemotherapies that are worse than death. And you have to tell the patient that your side effects are going to be so bad, you're going to want to die. Do you still want to take it? Patient says yes, go for it. But here we have this notion that the medication has so few side effects and is so safe for all the children that we don't consider that it causes in many children secondary psychiatric symptoms. So you have a kid who's struggling with ADHD symptoms, and then 1 in 10 of them is going to land up with depression or bipolar. Have we done the right thing? Do the parents know that that's one of the risks? I didn't know that. Mm-hmm. And I personally know children who have been on ADHD medication and now are suffering with much more severe psychiatric symptoms. Now, is that directly because of the Ritalin? Studies seem to indicate that it is, but it's still an open question. I'm not saying it's for sure. It's definitely correlated. And we have to look at that. But even just the child becoming passive in the classroom and not making friends because of that, or not making social mistakes and then being pushed back so that they learn the right thing to do. So we're kicking the child learning social norms and cues down the road. And now they're in 10th grade and they don't want their Ritalin anymore. And now they have no idea how to deal with it. So it is a good medication just because it exists. And therefore we can choose it if we want to, but don't run to do it until you know why your child's struggling, and make sure you're educated before you make that decision. And then I say, great, we got Ritalin.
Yeah, no, I hear you. And I think you're right in that sense of, like, it's your responsibility, certainly as a parent, to investigate this, right? And it's really hard because how are you supposed to know, right? If you're never told or never taught anything, you don't, you just rely on what your doctor tells you. And we've always been taught that, you know, if something's wrong, go to the doctor. It doesn't matter what it is. If they don't know what to do, they'll refer you to someone who does. And that's by and large good advice, but it comes at a cost sometimes, right? I don't suggest you do Google over a doctor. I don't think that's bad general advice, but then we might say, take what your doctor says cautiously and be curious about it and make sure you trust your doctor and their opinions and their directions. Sure. And maybe if you can look for a doctor that, if you don't have that, that you do trust, that's, you know, an enlightened doctor, you might say, that is going to take it as seriously as they should and not just give you 7 minutes or whatever it is, and really take the time to can. And they are, it's rare, but they're out there and it's complicated. But so if we take a look at...
Could I add one thing to that? Doctors don't actually get educated on different causes of ADHD symptoms. That's not part of their education. So even
is that because it's not known?
No, it is certainly known. In my first book, Hyperhealing, where I go through all of the different causes of ADHD, I didn't invent any of that. That is a compilation of fabulous researchers that I've studied, and I'm bringing it to the parents so parents don't have to spend 20 years doing the research I did. You know, I feel like we're all very busy, so I got it done. And now I want to pass that forward to every parent who's looking for those answers. But doctors, because they're just not trained in it, because what they're trained in is this is this pill and this is the side effects and these are the effects and this is what it does and this is what we use it for. And but they're not really trained in the background of causes of certain etiologies, basically, of these disorders. And therefore, even if you have the best doctor on the planet, the doctor might just not know.
Right.
And that's why I had to start doing research. There are great doctors around, and I certainly trust a lot of the doctors that I take my children to and that I go to myself. But if you're not trained in that, because you're being focusing on the pills themselves, then you just don't have that information.
Right. So I guess it comes down to the training and the education of the doctors, and what goes into it, which I can't really speak to because I haven't done medical school. But from what you're saying, I understand that. Could you give me 1 second? The dog's scratching at the door.
Sure.
Sorry, I have silly dogs. They want in and out and in and out, and they don't know what they want.
My dog scratches at the front door all the time. In the summer, I just leave it open because I can't anymore.
Yeah, that's a good idea. But so if we think about, like, briefly, like, what are some of the main causes that you would say from your research of ADHD? Because it was my understanding that there was no consensus of, like, this is the cause of ADHD, but rather that these are the potential causes of various symptoms associated with ADHD. Is that a fair distinction to make?
Yeah, 100%. The cause of ADHD is unknown. And that's the way I teach in college. And that's when I ask my students that question, what causes ADHD? If any of them gives me a definitive answer, I say wrong. It is unknown. Not because we don't know the different various causes, but because each person is going to have different things that cause their ADHD symptoms. So if you line up someone who has severe anxiety and therefore because of that, they're very fearful and they're making decisions that look very chaotic and look very ADHD-like, then I'm not going to say that that's a brain disorder. I'm going to say that let's look at the anxiety there, but that's not the main cause. Let's go through the more interesting causes of ADHD that we're going to see way more often. And everybody's different. So the first one is going to be the instant gratification personality. That's my favorite because that's the sentence that describes my family. It should be instant gratification family because that's a very strong genetic thing. Their father, my husband, is very much like that. And what's instant gratification? It's a healthy personality type, which is the here and now personality. The one that wants everything interesting and fun and intriguing and dangerous and on the edge and all that stuff. It's the curious people. It's the artists and the scientists and the entrepreneurs and the people who love going out in nature. They notice every detail and therefore they have a hard time focusing on one thing at a time because they're always taking everything in. So in terms of that person, like I said, healthy personality type, that would be great for an entrepreneur because they have to be keeping lots of things in mind at once. That would be great for an artist who has to consider a lot of different variants and parts of art in order to put something fabulous together. But here's the catch. That person is going to, because of their instant gratification personality, they want everything fabulous right now. But let's say you start a project and then you have to finish it. Well, that's a big problem for that person because they don't like to get into the nitty gritty. They don't like when it gets boring and then they just let it fall. So they're going to have messy rooms because cleaning and organizing is terrible. So you may get excited one day because you have a friend sleeping over and therefore you're going to clean your room perfectly. But the rest of the time, it's a nightmare. So unless you're stimulated by excitement, you're not moving. So I always use the shower example because this resonates with a lot of adults with ADHD and parents. It's like you want the kid to get in the shower and you have to call in security to get that child to stop playing their game and get into the shower. Once they're in there, they are so happy. They're singing. You can't get them out. When my kids were little, I'd fill up the bathtub, put a couple of them in there at once. That's just the way to do it when you have a lot of them. And then I'd never get them out of the bath. What I would do is I'd walk in there, I'd open the bath or pull out the plug. The water would drain. They'd suddenly realize it wasn't fun anymore. And then I'd be like, come get it off. I'd be like, sure. And I'd come and take them out of the bathtub because the transition's awful for them because they're having fun. Now you're stopping them, telling them become cold and uncomfortable. Get in the bath. They don't want to do that. So instant gratification personality. What just happened?
Looks like you lost electricity. But that's strange. Not electricity, just the lights in the room. Yeah, go sort it out.
1 second. Let me figure that one out.
sudden darkness. There we go. All fixed. There's light now.
That was strange.
Very strange.
All right, back to you.
Yeah.
So my training for instant gratification kids is, first of all, they are the kids that need all of our attention. And they're also the adults that need all of our attention. So we have to start by doing our own process. We're raising a kid like that, doing our own process of clearing our own thoughts, because we get angry at our children and we feel wronged. Why did I get this defective child who's not defective? But we feel that way. We really get so upset, and we criticized all the time by the neighbors and the teachers about our child's behavior, which is awful. And therefore we're critical of our children. These kids don't thrive with criticism. They need our positive reinforcement. And therefore we have to go through our own serious journey to figure out what are the voices in our own head, not schizophrenic voices, but regular voices of our own criticism, our own victimhood, what we're going through. And then we work on helping those children develop habits, because that's what they're missing. They can't get out of bed in the morning unless they're going to Six Flags. Well, that doesn't work. So we have to help them develop habits with using charts or using other programs. And then finally, we do have to have a very serious rules and discipline program, because they need that clarity more than anybody else in the world. So that's that one cause.
Solid structure.
A lot of structure, yeah. And they thrive on structure.
Yeah.
A second major cause, which I mentioned before, was a trauma, abuse, neglect. And anyone who's familiar with the ACEs study, that's a study that talks about the different adverse childhood experiences. And the more children have adverse childhood experiences, the higher number they have, the more likely it is they're going to be diagnosed with ADHD and other psychiatric conditions. So that's something we really have to look at and never pathologize the child, because the child is responding in a healthy way to an unhealthy environment. And we have to nurture that child back to health, back to an environment that's safe.
Yeah. And so the ADHD symptoms that present are the child's defense against whatever is happening to them or in their environment, right? And it's an automatic response that is protective. And then if the trauma is not dealt with, or it continues and, you know, the symptoms aren't addressed, then that carries through to adolescence and adulthood, where you are then sort of displaying what were adaptive behaviors now are maladaptive behaviors, because the trauma is no longer happening to you. But you know, if it hasn't been worked through properly and you haven't changed your behavior, then you're going to be stuck in that same place, right? And that's what therapy and stuff is for.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I love somatic therapy, because a lot of these people kids are holding on to memories they don't even know exist. And so using the mind-body connection is really powerful there. So that's exactly it. And to punish a child for behaviors when there are adaptive behaviors right now is really off. It's off the rails for us. It's dangerous for us. And we have to realize that we're impacting children by not listening to them and seeing what's going on for them.
And it compounds the problem.
I'll mention, what's that?
It compounds the problem. It doesn't make it better.
Absolutely. Because they're looking for an adult they can trust.
Yeah.
And that should be us. And I would say that the third big cause of ADHD symptoms, which you also mentioned before, is the gut dysbiosis, the something physiological going on. And that the way I would see that, and for any parent listening or an adult with ADHD symptoms, you're looking at if you have allergies, if you have sensory conditions, if you have skin rashes and things like that, if you have chronic stomach aches or headaches, anything physiological that's going on often, you want to stop yourself. You have diarrhea, constipation, things like that. You want to stop and say, okay, there's something wrong in my body, and And therefore, probably the behaviors that are coming through are being caused by what's going on in my body. And a sleep condition would be also, I tack that onto it as well, because that's also mm-hmm. going to be physiological. So if a child's not sleeping at night, you have to know that they cannot function well the next day. And if they're chronically not sleeping well, don't you diagnose ADHD until you make sure that kid's getting 9 solid hours of sleep.
Yeah. And would you say that, first of all, we all need sleep to function properly? Anyone who disagrees with that, it's complicated. but would you say that for this third group, right? Would you say that it's the physiological, so the other physiological issues that are causing symptoms of ADHD, or are they responsive to the problems that you're experiencing?
So my experience has been, and that's a great question. My experience has been that it's the physiological problems that are causing the ADHD symptoms. And the reason I can say that is because with the many clients I've treated with ADHD symptoms that I was quite sure are physiological, when we did what I call the 30-day challenge, chapter 10 in my first book, that, and it actually could be downloaded for free from my website, and which I'm assuming you're going to be linking. And so that's, yeah. I'm always happy to give that to anyone who's looking for it. And so that if you clean up the gut, the symptoms start to come down. Mm. And as the nose stops running, the child gets calmer. And that's why I'm seeing that actually do the diet, the adenoids, the sinuses, all that stuff is going to calm itself down. The kid's going to be able to breathe and then be able to sleep at night. And the symptoms definitely subside.
And is there a specific diet that you recommend, or is it a matter of investigating what specifically is problematic for any individual person or child?
So I do have a specific diet, and that's what I'm saying people could download from my website. I'm happy to give some highlights of it. And it's the functional medicine diet, essentially, with some changes here and there. I do recommend certain supplements. I don't have any connections to any supplement companies. I give general recommendations, but I start with eliminating gluten, dairy, sugar, processed food colorings. But I know that there are a couple of you out there having a panic attack right now. I highly recommend taking it slow, adjusting to it slowly. And gluten needs to be wiped out completely. None of that for just a month. And then you see, when you reintroduce it, you see, was it the gluten? But dairy, sugar could be used in moderation, gluten out. I recommend a probiotic. I recommend a very high quality multivitamin mineral supplement, just not for life, but just for the beginning. And lots of water. And then, of course, the bulk of the diet's going to be 70% vegetables, fruit, whole healthy grains, and adding to that clean meat, fish, and chicken, and much less of the junk food stuff. But we want to switch over to a way more plant-based diet with a little bit of animal protein as well, and staying away from the glutinous carbs.
Mm-hmm. I see. So it's about it's both. It's like getting rid of all the bad foods and then reintroducing the sort of common triggers, you might say, like dairy and gluten that affect a lot of people.
Yeah. And it doesn't work unless you're also really putting in a lot of the vegetables. Your gut needs to have those vegetables in order to be healthy and well adjusted. And therefore you have to eat them. So eat them in a way you enjoy. You know, it doesn't have to be raw. It could be in a soup, it could be in salad, whatever you like, but definitely putting in as many fruits and vegetables as possible is the way to go. Your gut will start functioning better. Anyone who has constipation, meaning that they're not eliminating twice a day, I always recommend taking some chia seeds. You soak that, a tablespoon of chia seeds, soak it in water, add it to whatever you want, or just drink it down. It's kind of jelly-ish, but has no taste. That helps. And magnesium is my absolute favorite. I recommend supplementing with magnesium, because that's another thing. You could really fix that quite quickly. And that really brings down symptoms nicely.
Yeah, I like magnesium. I take magnesium every day.
For
a variety. I mean, it's good for lots of things. I use the bisglycinate one, you know, which they say has more bioavailability or something like that. But that's just me. And so, but so the whole, your sort of approach to helping parents deal with kids with ADHD is work on, it's a multifaceted approach, right? You're looking at multiple areas of like, okay, well, we need to investigate why these things are happening, right? Not just assume it to be an ADHD cause. So would you say, and so you kind of like look at each individual symptom, right? And say, what's causing this symptom for this particular child or person, or children are people, but like child or adult or whatever.
I take it from the reverse, actually. I'm looking at each individual child instead of looking at the symptom. I'm looking at the child and saying, well, what's off over here? Is it their environment? Is it their body? Is it their experience? Like, what's happening here for the kid? And that would explain the symptoms pretty easily.
Oh, I see. So, okay. So that's actually the reverse of what I was saying, right? So you look at the child as a whole in its environment as a physical being and with all that goes with it, and see what's going on that might not be so good for the child. And then based on that, work to sort of change that and see if that reduces symptoms. So you don't look at the symptom and say what causes the symptom that way. It's more of a, so it's like, it's not a functional analysis. It's more of a reverse functional analysis, if I'm not mistaken.
Right. My diagnosis, I always say, I don't diagnose, I'm not a doctor, but the diagnostic process that people go through when they come to see me, whether by Zoom or in person, is my 1,000 question event, because I want to know everything about you from your birth till today. And then you and I together are going to piece that your story together, and we're going to, it's going to be clear to both of us by the end of that conversation, which is a lot of fun and interesting. And it's even interesting to people, like, why do you ask me that question? I say, you're going to understand soon. But it's a great process, and it's very revealing. And by the time we get to the end of the conversation, we understand.
Right. Each question is like a brushstroke on a painting, right? And you're putting the whole picture together. And then at the end, you can see what it is, even though each one on its own doesn't necessarily make sense. I don't know. That was just the image that came to mind when you said that. But okay, so if people have, you know, if they suspect they have ADHD, or if they've been given a diagnosis, right, and they want to look into it more, right, like from based on what you're saying and things like that, what's the best way for them to do it? Where can they find you if they want to have consultations? You know, please tell us about all of your stuff.
Sure. So they can certainly go to my website, which is hyperhealing.org. I just worked really hard on constructing two quizzes that will give people a lot of insight quickly, and also give people a tremendous amount of information. So if you're turning to my website because you have a child with ADHD, you can take that quiz for your child or for yourself as an adult with ADHD. And it will give you, it's a taste of all of those questions that I ask. And it will give you once your results are calculated, I'll send you a lot of material that you can use, big chunks of the book, a lot of information that you can use in order to get started. That's one thing that people can do to get help. Obviously, going through my book, either the paperback, the audio, or the ebook, is it on sale right now? I can't remember, but it's obviously not very expensive, and certainly a whole lot cheaper than coaching or any other therapies that you'd be looking for. So that'll give you a lot of information. And people could always book a 15-minute consultation that's free of charge. or they can book a session. If they want to get right into it with me, then with pleasure. I'm always happy to meet and really go on that journey with you.
Amazing. Well, thank you. This has been such a wonderful conversation. It's been great talking to you, and I hope we can do it again soon.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed it myself.
Good. All right. Take care. We'll be right back.